right, go ahead and have a seat. What a group, holy cow. Do we have a Central Wisconsin Christian School here today? Can you stand up if you're here? We want to say hello.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi, back at you.
Excellent. Love it. All right, go ahead and have a seat. Welcome. Do we have another school here as well? I don't have another name. Who are you? Excellent. Stand up. We're glad to have you here. Wow. Excellent. Any particular class? Wonderful. Well, welcome to it in Wisconsin. Go ahead and have a seat. Great to see you all here today. This is a packed room. We don't often have people except for bar admissions sitting up this close. So welcome. Hopefully you enjoy your time here today. Afterwards, Justice Karofsky would be willing to talk to you today around the noon hour.
Thank you.
She can't talk about the case, but you could ask her all sorts of really pressing questions. Make them tough. She likes it. The tougher, the better.
Thanks, Chief.
And so there we have it. With that, I think we'll get going this morning with Davis versus Circuit Court for Dane County. This is 22 AP 1999. Could I start with your appearances?
Kelsey Loshaw on behalf of Mr. Davis.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, Senator Matthews on behalf of the Circuit Court and the Honorable Ellen Capers.
Good morning. All right, I have 25 minutes followed by 25
Chief Justice,
minutes.
We have another party.
Followed by 5 minutes and your appearance for the. Great. And then 5 minutes in rebuttal. Do I have everyone lined up correctly? Good. Let's proceed.
Good morning, Justices. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. I represent Mr. Antonio Davis. Every defendant is entitled to intelligently exercise the right of substitution. When that right, by no fault of their own, is taken away, courts must exercise flexibility when granting a request for substitution. The right of substitution is rooted in preserving fairness, and in a criminal action, the judge is the entity most directly affecting a defendant's liberty. So the decision whether or not to substitute against a particular judge, where a defendant has invoked the right to counsel, requires that they get to conference with that counsel and gain the expertise of that attorney when considering all of the relevant factors before deciding whether or not to file a substitution request.
That right is not a constitutional one, correct?
It is not.
It's just rooted in the statutory text?
Correct. Correct. The policy is still that it ensures fairness, which obviously is a constitutional goal, but no, there's no argument that he had a constitutional right to substitute here. But here,
does the judiciary have the right to change the language of a statute in order to achieve its view of fairness?
Yes. This court has before looked at the statute and how to apply it and where otherwise strict construction would interfere with the defendant's fairness or ensuring fairness. This court has relaxed the strict application of statutes, specifically in substitution cases.
The court might have done that in the past, but where does the court have the right to do that? Because it's basically overriding what the legislature has enacted as a matter of policy. It's been called a matter of legislative grace. So what right does the judiciary have to rewrite a statute that's enacted by the people's representatives in the legislature?
This court has the ability to ensure that the policy in the behind the legislature, behind the statute, is met. And in this case, the policy or the intent behind 97120 is to ensure fairness. So when a strict application doesn't do that, this court has relaxed the application in the past.
But I'm asking you, I know we've done it, but where is the authority for the judiciary to do that? Because the Constitution is quite clear in giving the lawmaking power to the legislature, not to the judiciary, even if the results of the statute are not fair in our perspective.
Correct. But this court has the ability to ensure that the intent of the statute is being met.
We actually don't look at legislative intent anymore since the Kalal case.
I understand that. But what I'm saying here is that this court has previously looked at, especially in the context of a supervisory writ, whether or not a substitution request is actually ensuring that the defendant has the right to intelligently exercise this substitution.
Where was the plain duty, since we are under the posture of a supervisory writ? That's discretionary, so I don't see where the judge here had a plain duty to relax the language of the statute.
Two things. So first, the court did have a plain duty to apply the legal standards, the Baldwin rationale, if you will, to the facts of this case. And if it had done that, it would have certainly found that there was a government-created obstacle that interfered with Mr. Davis's right to intelligently exercise substitution.
Was this Baldwin before or after Kalal? Or Kalal?
Kalal.
Like Baldwin was 1974.
And when was Kalal?
After.
2004.
Yeah. And this court has consistently, since Baldwin, through the entirety of the case law regarding supervisory writs when the court is discussing whether or not to grant a writ based on the denial of a substitution request, that it hasn't changed. The way that this court looks at it hasn't changed through time.
I might have missed what you said. I think Justice Rebecca Bradley asked you about the plain duty. I heard you say you had two responses. Did you give both responses or just one?
No. So first, the court had a plain duty to do this.
Under the Baldwin rationale.
Yes. And second, this court has consistently looked at these sorts of cases under this court has preferred the method to be a supervisory writ. So certainly this court could change their mind and say we are no longer going to address whether or not a substitution was denied properly under a different mechanism, but this court has regularly said that the preferred method is a supervisory.
Can I just ask a follow-up real quick? I'm not following your argument. If the question is, did the judge in this case violate the plain duty, you're saying she did because we have consistently preferred supervisory writ to be,
It was more so two issues with, we were talking about supervisory writs and how under a supervisory, why a supervisory writ is, why this court has talked about supervisory writs in the past when we're dealing with a denial of substitution request. But the court had a plain duty in this case to grant the substitution request. And that was because there was a government-created obstacle where the court entered a plea and Mr. Davis was not able to confer with counsel about whether or not to substitute within the time limit set by the statute or the local rule. And therefore, he was not able to intelligently exercise his right to substitution, which is why this court should grant the writ.
So, counsel, I spent a lot of years in my career in intake courts, and I agree they are very, very busy, and the people representing the accused are very busy. I guess what I don't understand, and I would ask you to comment on, is why didn't Mr. Davis' counsel request to have that substitution argument or substitution right reserved? I don't understand that. I mean, typically, you know, I would see it time and time again, somebody representing the defendant saying we're asking to reserve this right. Why wasn't that done, if you know?
Reserving the right, there's still an argument that it would be an untimely request when the right is reserved, because the statute says that it has to be made before arraignment. And here, the intake attorney's duty, luckily I was a trial attorney for many years before I was here, so I'm very comfortable with the process and procedure of that. But reserving the right wouldn't necessarily actually do anything procedurally, but also there's an easier way to do it, which is to tell the courts, this court could use its superintending authority, to tell courts to refrain from entering a plea unnecessarily and potentially prematurely at the intake court. And that actually would better deal with some of the potential delays. It would ensure that we could get this case moving in front of the actual court assigned with counsel, as counsel did appear with Mr. Davis at the next scheduled appearance.
So we don't have a transcript, but I'm assuming from the way that it looks like it went is that he was essentially arraigned, meaning the plea was entered on his behalf, and then after that was informed which judge it was assigned?
Yes.
So that there is no way to possibly know about whether you should substitute or not or make that decision intelligently before the arraignment.
No, and I think that's why the focus from the state has consistently been on the local rule about whether or not he was told who the judge was before he was arraigned.
It's curious whether a local rule could violate it. I didn't say violate, but have a different time frame than a statute when it's the legislature who is making this decision. How can a local rule give really even do anything at that point?
I agree. I think the local rule is a recognition that the statute does not address the problem. We can all agree that originally when the statute was written, it had the intent of being of defendants being able to appear at the initial appearance with their assigned attorney. That doesn't happen. So when we talk about the local rule, I think it attempts to remedy an issue of potentially a premature arraignment. But in this case, it didn't go far enough. And Mr. Davis didn't have counsel after the court triggered that deadline without telling him the judge for within that 20 days. So here, the local rule is great if it works, but it doesn't here. It doesn't solve the problem.
I just want to push back on that. I think the only one up here who has practice in Dane County, I was in intake court as an assistant DA many, many times and observed intake court as a circuit court judge in Dane County. And there's always an attorney, right? And there was an attorney. And this is what your friends on the other side point out. And in fact, as it turns out in this case, it was the same attorney, which is happenstance in this situation. But it wasn't as if Mr. Davis was appearing pro se at the initial appearance. He did have a lawyer there. And the lawyer there could have, and the lawyer there has been in Dane County and knows who the judges are in Dane County and could have filed a motion to substitute at that time or shortly thereafter. So I understand what you're saying, and I understand about the 20-day rule, and I understand as well as I can, not being in your shoes or the shoes of anyone in the public defender's office, how difficult a time it is right now for you to be able to get representation for all the people who need it. But the fact of the matter was that in this case and in this situation and at this initial appearance, Mr. Davis had, and I know it's a very capable attorney because it's someone who she appeared in front of me.
Many, I agree.
Many, he's a great attorney. Fabulous attorney, standing next to him at the initial appearance.
So that was limited scope counsel. There's no attorney assigned at the intake. And there's a couple of reasons why that doesn't happen. The amicus brief did a really good job of going through and discussing exactly why limited scope counsel cannot and should not make decisions such as substitution. Once you substitute, that's it. So, and we know that substituting a particular judge has to take into consideration a multitude of factors. It could be that a defendant just doesn't like that judge. It could be the calendaring system, and a defendant wants to get in front of a judge, a different judge, who the attorney assigned knows has a better calendar. But once that's done, once the decision to substitute is made, you can't take it back. So if then you have counsel, who obviously in this case it was the same, but let's say you have different counsel then who's appointed, which is typical, then that attorney is stuck with the decision of an attorney who was not counsel for Mr. Davis at the time. We have many situations where, as an intake attorney, you're potentially representing four different defendants charged in one criminal complaint. So to somehow make a legal decision for one when you have potentially conflicts for three others is not plausible, and it actually borders on potentially unethical for an intake attorney, limited scope, who is not actually representing the defendant at that point in time and may not ever represent the defendant, to be making substantive legal decisions for that person.
Counsel, why should we not dismiss this, since the issue for which we took the petition has changed? You advance a different government actor or action here. So tell me why we shouldn't say you've forfeited this issue and dismiss the action.
We haven't forfeited any argument. We haven't abandoned or waived any argument. You can't waive the use of historical facts. The issue is and always has been that there is the court had a plain duty to grant the request for substitution because there was a government-created obstacle. But for the court entering a plea, we wouldn't be here. So it is relevant to this court's determination. I know that the state would prefer to ignore facts that are harmful or potentially not helpful to their argument, but I think that really distracts from what the issue is and always has been, which is, did the court have
I don't think that's their position. I think their position is that the argument changed, right? So I think what Justice Anwash Bradley is saying is, did you forfeit this issue because this wasn't the issue that you argued down below? And I don't hear the state making that argument. I hear them saying, you didn't argue it down below, so you forfeited it.
Well, we did argue that the court had a plain duty to grant the writ based on a government-created obstacle.
But the obstacle has changed.
The obstacle has always been the historic facts of the case.
Counsel, it appears to me that the obstacle has changed.
That's fine, Your Honor. And if that's the case, I fully understand that this court has the ability to grant this as improvidently grant or to dismiss this as improvidently granted. However, there are multiple avenues that this court can hear the case under. First of all, even if it is forfeited, the court can still hear the case. But in this case, in these sorts of cases where there's a supervisory writ based on a denial of a substitution request, this court has left open the avenue of an appeal as of right. So we could be back here in 9 months' time if the court decides that they don't want to actually hear or decide the substantive issues based on some sort of forfeiture.
Except that if you're here then, it's discretionary potentially and it's harmless error potentially.
Potentially, but I don't think it's harmless error because I think it has to, the harmless error it can't be harmless error because he has to proceed with the judge that he asked to substitute against.
Be hard to show otherwise at that point. My question for you though is, why not interlocutory appeal? Wouldn't that have been the way to go and address it right then and there?
This court, all I can say is that this court's preferred method in the case law has been through a supervisory writ.
For cases that all were, where the request was all made within the statutory time frame. Those were denials. I believe every one of those was a denial of the right to substitute, but there was never an issue as to whether it was made properly within the time frame.
Zimbol is probably the only one that was made within the time frame. There are other substitution requests where we're talking about, I look back to Tinty and Tesmer, and those requests were made outside the statutory time limit. Those were made after arraignment without a local rule. So those were not a timely request.
Okay.
Did you forfeit the equitable tolling argument?
No, if this court wants to decide that, but I think that issue has also been raised in the Court of Appeals and here. I think the court.
Did you raise it at the Circuit Court?
I'd have to go back and look. I didn't raise it at the Circuit Court. I don't know if it was actually addressed. I can say that Zimbol was discussed and addressed in the actual briefing that was there, the motion. That went along with the substitution request. Certainly that talks about equitable tolling. I brought it as an alternative way if this court does not, and it was briefed in the Court of Appeals, as an alternative way if this court is uncomfortable with making a broader rule. I'm not asking the court to make a broader rule. I'm just asking the court to grant the writ here.
I understand that we have suggested that the supervisory writ is a preferred method, and some of my colleagues have suggested maybe this case shows why that may not be the case. In particular, this equitable tolling argument, which, you know, might be an argument that could be made in other circumstances, seems like it's a particularly poor fit for a supervisory writ. I'm trying to figure out how you could have a mandatory and plain legal duty to act equitably to do something. It just doesn't seem to make any sense to me.
Again, I would just hearken back to the intent of the legislature was to ensure fairness, and I think equitable tolling. So whether or not this court wants to continue to hear these on supervisory writ, that's this court's decision. But I think in this sort of circumstance, it was an additional legal avenue where this court wouldn't have to make any broader issue. Or
pretty hard, though, to say that the circuit court judge had a mandatory duty to act fairly under the circumstances. I'm trying to think of the floodgate of litigation that would open up if that's the rule this court adopted.
That's fair. I don't think it's that they had a duty to act fairly. I think it's that they had a duty to grant the writ because not doing so would deny him the right to intelligently exercise substitution. I don't think there will be a floodgate of litigation. I don't think that's a concern for this court. I mean, certainly there's already an avenue for this court to hear these sorts of cases. There also theoretically is a way, even if counsel doesn't request a substitution, that a defendant could theoretically bring this on an IAC claim. But that's available now, so I don't necessarily think that there's a potential floodgates issue. I think there's more of a potential issue if we don't have consistency across the state in terms of how we are making sure that a defendant has the ability to exercise this right intelligently.
Did Mr. Davis' counsel ask the court commissioner not to enter the plea?
No, and again, I think that goes back to whether or not we should be having intake attorneys making substantive decisions about how to proceed. Certainly the court.
So what exactly is their role then?
Their role at initial appearance is to hopefully have done an eligibility determination, to talk to the defendant, answer any questions about what's happening at the initial appearance, to argue bail in front of the court, and to hopefully get a copy at the intake appearance of the criminal complaint so the defendant is noticed of the charges against them. That's it.
Not even any kind of argument as to whether or not probable cause has been established?
Yes. That's hopefully when the attorney is there and able, hopefully, to review, do a quick review of the criminal complaint, that could be something that is encompassed in the scope of the representation. But it is very limited scope representation for the reasons that I set forth before and the reasons in the amicus brief. And it has to be that way. Your Honors, I think here the government created obstacle, again, was that Mr. Davis was unrepresented but SVD eligible, not given counsel to discuss the right to substitution within the 20 days set by local rule, where the court entered a plea and triggered the deadline. This court should grant the writ here and find that his request was timely, even though not statutorily timely, not technically timely. If your honors have no other questions, I will wait till my next round.
Okay.
Thank you.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Assistant Attorney General Jennifer Vandermeus, on behalf of the Circuit Court for Dane County and the Honorable Ellen K. Burrs. As we explained in our brief, this case is not a good vehicle for law development, and we are asking this court to dismiss this matter without rendering an opinion. In the alternative, we ask this court affirm the Court of Appeals' denial of Davis's petition for a supervisory writ, primarily because Davis failed to establish that the circuit court violated a plain duty when it denied his untimely substitution request. So I'll begin by going through the reasons why we don't think that this case is a good vehicle for law development.
Counsel, I want to ask just a question about Justice Dallet had thrown out the point that, and so there's been some discussion here, that perhaps the supervisory writ isn't the best vehicle for addressing some of these questions that arise. She had, you know, thrown out the possibility, why not an interlocutory appeal? You know, it seems that one of the issues, to the extent there's an issue here, and I can feel for the situation that Mr. Davis had, could you address that as a possible, you know, instruction that we could give for a sort of vehicle for these things to be resolved in a different manner? I understand that's a little outside this case, but, you know, for looking at this case, there was a problem here. And I think in defense of Mr. Davis's counsel, that he was trying to follow what we had said, and so it makes us think what's the best way to move forward. How can we ensure these things are handled in an appropriate way? Do you have thoughts on that?
Yep, I do. So I will acknowledge that the Clark decision says that supervisory writs are the preferred vehicle for addressing substitution decisions, but there's also plenty of precedent where substitution issues are addressed on direct appeal or in petitions for leave to appeal. It's not out of the question for that to be a proper vehicle. I think it really depends. And so if you look at the state ex rel Tesmer decision, that was a petition for supervisory writs, and I believe that the facts were that the defendant didn't have notice of who their judge was. And so the Court of Appeals took the granted the writ and said, gee, this case looks a lot like Baldwin, and we are holding that you had a plain duty under Baldwin to, you know, construe this substitution request as timely. So there are, I think, different, depending on the situation, a supervisory writ petition may be a fine vehicle to use. But in cases in like this, I'll just take what they asked for in their petition for this court's review. Development of the law in terms of what a government-created obstacle is under the facts of this case, as well as consideration of equitable tolling. Now, that sounds a lot like an appeal is a better vehicle for deciding those issues. So to return to our reasons why we think this case is not a good vehicle for law development, the issues are either forfeited or otherwise not proper to decide in the context of a supervisory writ petition. So Davis, in his brief to this court, asks this court to find that the timing of the arraignment, which happened in this matter at the same time as the initial appearance, was a government-created obstacle that impeded Davis's ability to exercise the right of substitution intelligently. Now, as we've already been discussing, this is a different argument than what Davis advanced in the lower courts and in his petition for this court's review. So this court knows under their own rules that if a petition for review is granted, parties cannot generally raise or argue issues that were not set forth in the petition. And this court is also very familiar with rules of judicial administration, where appellate courts generally decline to consider arguments not raised or developed in the lower courts. So with those principles in mind, there are at least three reasons that counsel against this court deciding this new issue at this time. First, this court doesn't have the benefit of the lower court's analysis of the issue. It would be helpful to this court if the lower courts had examined and addressed what facts are material to decide whether the timing of the arraignment constitutes a government-created obstacle. For example, does it matter that this is relatively standard practice in counties to hold arraignments and initial appearances at the same time for misdemeanor cases? It would also be helpful if lower courts had applied what they viewed as material facts to the law and the legal standards to decide if this really did pose a government-created obstacle consistent with this court's precedent. We just don't have any analysis here on this new issue. So, the second reason why we don't think that this issue should be decided today is because the record is not adequately developed to consider the argument. As Justice Dallet noted, there's no transcript in this matter with regard to the initial appearance. So we don't know precisely how the commissioner went about entering Davis's pleas. The record is silent as to whether there was an objection. I believe the other side has said that there wasn't, but there is nothing in the record that talks about that. And we also don't know much about the county's practices for holding arraignments at initial appearances or what the reasons for doing so might be.
Can I push back on all of that? I mean, you've raised some really interesting things, but we've got a straightforward statute, and we know what happened here. And it violated the statute. Like, it just did. Because there's no possible way this individual could substitute or even make that decision about whether to substitute prior to being arraigned. I mean, you even agree to that with that, I would assume. So all of these other things are really not, they don't develop anything here. What we have is a statute, and we have a potential of how to interpret the statute in a way that we have in the past, that maybe we give it leniency. I heard Justice Rebecca Bradley's pushback on that. But it's pretty straightforward. It seems to me that the issue is more of what's happening in these counties and that they may be violating the statute for whatever reason, right? Does it matter what reason they're violating the statute?
I'm giving the reasons why we don't believe that this issue is ripe for decision at this time. And I'm hearing this court, Justice Dallet, your concern about the statute being violated. And we did go on in our brief to this court to address why we don't think, even aside from the fact that it shouldn't be decided in the vehicle of this case, why we don't think that that argument has merit. And we have been talking about the statute, and I know that you asked questions about the Dane County local rule, but the fact is there was a local rule that Davis himself acknowledged in his request for substitution. He relied on that local rule and said, I know that I'm late under the local rule, but I didn't have counsel. So there, when they said that it was the state that's focusing on the local rule, it was really not us focusing on the local rule so much as them focusing on the local rule.
I think the concern is this, and this might be where some of us are struggling. I understand your argument for why you think that the issue is forfeited. And I understand that Davis relied on the local rule. It just seems like we have this system set up in Dane County where someone is arraigned before they even know who the judge assigned is. And so I think we're struggling with, is there anything we can do about that in this case? Is there anything we should do about this in this case? My guess is, having looked at the statute a little bit, and the statute changed, right? Like in 81, it changed from or to and. I don't know if you know anything about this or if the state knows anything about the change in the statute. It might not matter for the purpose of today's discussion, but I do think that's interesting. But there's no opportunity and my guess is that the arraignment happens at that time, and there hasn't been a problem in the past because there have been more public defenders. PD's office is in a crisis right now as far as getting enough attorneys to be able to represent defendants all throughout the state. Mm-hmm. It used to be that you'd have the arraignment, but usually the attorney standing next to the defendant was very likely to be the attorney who was going to stay on that case. They weren't at the initial appearance for the limited representation that we were talking about a few minutes ago. But now we are in a situation where there's one PD assigned in the bigger counties, and I can only speak for Dane County. My understanding from listening to Justice Protasiewicz and Justice Dallet is that's also what happens in Milwaukee County. I don't know what's going on in Green Bay County or Outagamie County, the middle population counties, or the smaller counties. I don't know if they're running into the same issues there and if arraignment's happening at the same time there. But the fact that arraignment is happening at the same time, at least in Milwaukee and Dane County, means that for a lot of defendants, I don't know how they're supposed to be able to exercise this right to substitution. So is there anything that we should be saying to that?
It's a tough answer, perhaps, but not in this case. This is a supervisory writ, and the question is whether the circuit court violated a plain duty when it denied Davis's undisputably untimely request for substitution. And given the local rule, given this court's precedent, which I'm going to talk through in a minute, The answer is no. There was no violation of a plain duty here, and it would be concerning for there to be any other kind of a decision in this case, because supervisory writs are very specific vehicles that are designed to help judges and other officers exercise plain duties properly. And that is, this would be going well beyond that. And we are just in the confines of what the supervisory writ vehicle is. So I would, that would actually bring me to that, the, my next point about why this particular issue is not ready for a decision at this time. Because to the extent it is recurring, to the extent it is concerning, it will not evade review because it is possible to develop this question in the context of a future appeal. So for those reasons, this court should not decide whether the timing of the arraignment was a government-created obstacle. It was forfeited, and we just don't have a good record to make a decision.
If there was no local rule, and that's, I think that's really confusing to me about this case, is the interaction of those two, and I understand that you guys recognize that and talked about it in your briefs, that we don't have an issue sort of properly presented about the interaction between the local rule and the statute. If there was no local rule, do you think that Mr. Davis's arguments fall squarely within some of the prior cases that have been decided?
If there was no local rule, we would be closer to Tesmer and Baldwin. Because, again, I don't view from the record clear timing on how this all played out in terms of when the arraignment happened and when the notice happened. We know that the notice that Davis was given notice at the initial appearance. But putting all that to the side, if there was no local rule, we would be closer to the cases in which this court has construed the deadline as timely.
Can you expand a little bit on the closer word? There's a lot hinging on that, potentially. But it's my understanding is that the notice was there. The statute says before, right?
Yes, 971.20 sub 4?
Yeah.
Yes.
So that can you help me understand why that would still, he would still potentially be able to exercise a right to substitution if he didn't have knowledge of who his judge was before arraignment?
Yeah, perhaps it would help if I just quick summarized what the case law is on this government-created obstacle. So in Baldwin and Clark, this court, the basic principles in those cases were this. If the defendant did not have notice of who their judge was prior to the deadline running, so prior to arraignment, then the court was going to construe the statute liberally and hold that the defendant timely requested substitution, because otherwise it's really, it defeats the purpose of the statute if it's impossible for the defendant to comply with it because the defendant doesn't know who their judge is, right? So our whole point in our brief is that in this case, you know, and this is kind of getting to the difference between the local rule and the statute, but Davis did know who his judge was the day that his 20-day deadline under the local rule began to run.
But my assumption is take out the local rule for a minute. I want to throw that to the side. I know that's here. I know that the arguments were made on that. So, I know you have all kinds of arguments resting on that. Mm-hmm. But take that out and follow my hypothetical.
If the defendant had notice of who his judge was before arraignment, then we would be closer but not exactly in Baldwin and Clark. If the defendant didn't know who the judge was until after, now again, this is hypothetical because he did know before his deadline, but
he knew at arraignment, right? That's when it was given to him, as at arraignment, from what I understand.
Yeah, and again, it's hard for me. The reason I'm perhaps hesitant is because I don't have a transcript. Like, it's very hard for me to talk about this hypothetically when I just don't have developed facts. I'm not totally comfortable with just making assumptions, which is why we've been pushing the idea that this would have been better brought as an appeal where we could have had a fully developed record.
What if we add into that, though, even assuming he got it at the same time he's arraigned, he doesn't have counsel. If you accept, which I think we have to, the argument from defense that this was limited counsel, this was not
counsel there to protect his rights going forward in this case. It's as if he was pro se for purposes of substitution. He didn't have an attorney for that purpose at the time of this hearing, and he didn't have one within the 20-day local rule, even if you add that in. So what does that do to this? How do we wrestle with that fact that we have a pro se person who doesn't have counsel because the public defender's office didn't have the capability to appoint one for him?
So this court has to wrestle with that fact in the context of a petition for supervisory writ. So given its narrow function, as we've been discussing, the writ won't be granted unless the trial court's duty is plain and the court acted in violation of the duty. So as you were just saying, Justice Dallet, here I'll just say what it's undisputed as. It's undisputed that Davis filed his request for substitution more than 2 months after the local rule deadline ran. He had not yet retained counsel, but there was an intake attorney there, which we've been talking about a little bit today. It is also undisputed that he received notice of his assigned judge at the initial appearance, the same hearing at which he entered pleas. So given those facts in the supervisory writ context as applied to existing case law, the Court of Appeals properly held that the circuit court did not violate a plain duty when it denied Davis's untimely request for substitution. And so whether or not Davis is represented is not really directly at play in the context of whether there was a plain duty here. And the reason why is just examining the relevant case law. So in the circuit court and in the Court of Appeals, Davis hung his hat on law that liberally construed substitution deadlines when government-created obstacles prevented defendants from exercising the right to substitution intelligently. The principles that are stated in those cases will help clarify the plain duty that we're talking about here today. So the first principle is this. If the defendant, whether pro se or represented, doesn't have notice of who their judge is when the deadline expires, that deadline is liberally construed to allow the defendant to exercise their substitution right intelligently, or in this court's words, with knowledge of who the judge was. That is what this court said was meant by exercising your right to substitution intelligently. That's Clark v. State, and that's Baldwin v. State. Now, in State ex rel Tesmer, the Court of Appeals relied on Baldwin and granted a petition for supervisory writ because at the time the substitution deadline expired, the defendant didn't know who his assigned judge was. Now, notably in that case, the analysis didn't center on the fact that the defendant was unrepresented at the time that the deadline ran. So again, we're looking at this law to see what is the plain duty here? What was the circuit court required to do under the law? And the principle here that you don't deny a request when the defendant doesn't have notice in time is just not present here because he did. So the next government-created obstacle that's defined in this court's case law includes when a circuit court judge affirmatively extends the deadline. Now, that was State v. Zimbel.
That was a brilliantly written majority opinion.
I was just about to say that.
But lo and behold, there were some separate writings. And one of the separate writings came up with what I thought might be a new test. And that separate writing was joined by some members of this current court. That was a 2017 case. And that test was not vis-a-vis plain duty, but in terms of the equitable tolling test. And the test, as I recall, was, look, if the defendant acted in good faith and there was no prejudice shown to the state, regardless of what the statute says, strict compliance is not required of the statute. Is that your understanding of the concurring opinion?
Chief Justice Rogensack's concurring opinion.
Yes.
That opinion said I would have used equitable tolling principles rather than placing the decision kind of in that government-created obstacle framework.
That's right. And so strict compliance would not be, of the words of the statute, would not be required in the kind of circumstance that you were talking about with regard to Zimbel, where the judge actually instructs the defendant to wait, as I recall. So we've got several examples of not strict compliances. What of the words of the statute, right, and Zimbel being one. Does the defendant here lose because of the posture of the case, where the defendant might otherwise prevail if this were not the posture of a writ?
So we did address briefly government-created obstacle, equitable tolling in our brief, because you know we led with the fact that this is a supervisory writ, and you know I maintain that. But
I'm going to interrupt you just briefly.
Sure.
You know, since you need a plain duty with a supervisory writ, equity by definition is discretionary and therefore not plain.
Yes.
But that's not my question. My question is, if they were in a different posture, do you advance that we should be adhering strict compliance to the words of the statute in this case?
So what I would say from the circuit court's perspective is that the case law right now talks about government-created obstacles in two contexts, whether you had notice of the judge, which we know was not present here, or whether the circuit court affirmatively extended the deadline. I mean, the hypothetical that Justice Protase was raised with intake counsel saying, could we reserve our right? I mean, maybe the judge could have said, sure, we can visit this down the road. But in this case, we don't think that the arguments advanced fit with the government-created obstacles that this court has defined. And I would just say, too, because I'm starting to run out of time, that the kind of reply argument was that the judge had a plain duty to apply the law to the facts. I would just ask this court to review the Kalal decision, because I think a similar argument was advanced in terms of the court had a plain duty to apply the law to the facts. And the court in that case said to have it be that broad would extend supervisory jurisdiction to a virtually unlimited range of decisions involving the finding of facts and application of law. The obligation of judges to correctly apply the law is general and implicit in the entire structure of our legal system. So they're really, for the supervisory writ petition to be meaningful, we really need to keep it narrowly tailored to what the plain duties are in the context of existing case law. And so we really believe that because of the changes in the arguments and the fact that these arguments were not properly raised and developed below, and we don't have a fully fleshed out record, that the best course of action is to dismiss this matter without rendering an opinion. In the alternative, we are asking this court to narrowly affirm the Court of Appeals decision, primarily because the court did not violate a plain duty. We also advanced an alternative reason for no showing of irreparable harm due to the fact that there are different vehicles for getting at concerns about judges that were not used here. And right now, we are just in the scope of a supervisory writ. Thank you. Unless anybody has questions.
I just wanted to follow up on the characterization of Zimbel, which you seemed to agree with. But the problem with Zimbel actually illustrates the difficulties we run into when judges don't follow the law, right? Because in that case, the judge basically told the statute by saying, we'll just deal with this at another time, notwithstanding the statutory deadline. So I take issue with the suggestion that this court has, as it did in 1974, continued to just disregard the text of the statute when it feels like fairness requires it. So you weren't suggesting in your argument that the court has license to do that.
No, right? And actually, Justice Bradley, I heard your concern raised on the other side with respect to that. And I would just say this. Right now, we're just asking, did the circuit court here have a plain duty to deny an untimely request for substitution? To answer that question, we have to look at the case law that we have, and we have to look at the local rule and everything that was in front of the circuit court when it made that decision. And the resounding answer is no, the court did not have a plain duty to overlook the deadline in this matter.
Is it your position that the good faith error and no prejudice advanced by the state is not a test that should be endorsed?
I see that my red light is on. May I answer your question? So if you're talking about what was discussed in Zimbel, I think that that actually points to another problem that we had here, because if that was in the context of equitable tolling, I can't remember. The state didn't have notice that this was an argument that was raised in circuit court because it was in advance, and so there wasn't an opportunity to assess whether there was any prejudice. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Abigail Potts. May it please the court. I'm here on behalf of the state of Wisconsin. I only have a few minutes, so a couple things I wanted to just make sure that I focus on today is, one, we agree with the court respondents that this case can be denied and dismissed based on the writ standard alone, and it should be done in order to protect the writ as a vehicle. But two, I hear concern from the court on wanting to address the problem at issue in this case. So if this court decides that it wants to issue a decision that goes beyond that and either is advisory or gives some sort of clarity to the law in this area, we would really urge the court to do a few things. And one is to protect the writ standard. So make clear that we're protecting that standard. We are not saying that the applicability of equitable relief is a plain. We need to make sure that courts are not confused on that. We also need to really go through and look at the case law. I think the case law in this case has gotten very distorted because there are writ cases, there are equitable relief cases, and there are substitution cases. And sometimes they overlap. They don't all three overlap in this court. And that is why there's no precedent for what Davis is asking this court to do. So I would really urge the court to make sure that we really go back and look at these cases. A lot of these cases are court of appeals cases. They're not even Supreme Court cases, the Zintes and things like that. And so we need to give better guidance on that. One of the issues we really do need guidance on is the fact that whether the supervisory writ is the preferred method of addressing this. I think if you look at the cases that have said that, those cases mean in situations where the judge either is not deciding the request for substitution or the substitution was strictly timely and got it wrong based on their interpretation of what had happened in the case. Something like that, those are plain duty type cases where a supervisory writ might be that preferred method. But I think it gets very confused when we're talking about it through other cases, and we have to also make sure that we're considering that this is a case requesting equitable relief, and that is not something this court has done in the writ context. And then I would also just say that if I got some sense that the court wants to figure out a way to guide or help defendants in this situation, and if the court decides to go in that direction, I would say that defendants need to identify the equitable doctrine that they believe they are entitled to relief under at the circuit court, and they need to make the showing for it. And then if they don't get the decision they like, they can pursue an interlocutory appeal. But it is just, a supervisory writ is just not a vehicle for assessing the applicability of a discretionary doctrine, especially a doctrine that is so, so fact-specific. And in this case, I think that's where a lot of the problems in this case, a lot of talking over each other comes in this case, is that the vehicle is a bad vehicle for making law on most of these issues. And so then we really do support the court respondent's position that this case should be denied as either improvidently granted or affirm the Court of Appeals on that basis.
If the law is so mushy with regard to writ cases and substitution cases and equitable tolling issues, why shouldn't we provide guidance? This is a huge area that is causing a lot of concern and consternation around the state, I think. And so why shouldn't we take this opportunity to provide guidance as instead of taking a pass on the issue for procedural reasons?
And when you reference a problem throughout the state, are you referencing the delay in getting permanent counsel?
It's all intertwined. Yes, that's part of it. You know, that the first government obstacle was the whole delay in counsel, SPD, backlog sort of thing. And that is not the focus here today, of course. But I think in some instances it's intertwined.
Well, I think, as I said, I think there are, if the court wants to get beyond what we're asking it to do, if it wants to go on into a decision on the applicability of equitable relief, I would urge the court to clarify a few things, and I think that can be helpful for defendants in this case. The supervisory writ is only the preferred method for addressing substitution in very specific situations where there is a plain duty at issue. And a government-created obstacle does not necessarily make a plain duty. And that's one thing I think that gets a little confused in this case law as well, is we start getting into equitable territory then, where you're looking fact-specific at a certain case and determining whether or not under the facts of that case, some sort of easing of the interpretation of the law. And I see my red light is on. I apologize. Should I finish?
You can wrap up, though.
Okay. Whether the facts of that case warrant easing the construction of that law or that statute. That is not a plain duty. And I think that's one thing that needs to be made clear.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you all.
All right. Bottom.
All right, I just have two responses, and then I'm happy to answer any additional questions. But when we're looking at the history of the case law, I don't think it's actually correct to talk about this court having limited what is actually the intelligent exercise of the right. If we look at Clark, that wasn't actually about whether or not he had notice of the judge. The record was actually silent on whether or not he had notice of the judge. If we look at the cases that came in the 90s, Mace and Strong, those cases were not actually, the defendant in both of those cases effectively, for all intents and purposes, knew who the judge was. But what we do have is in Zimbel, this court, talking about how the Baldwin rationale has been extended to other cases where the defendant has been unable to make a request for substitution due to a government-created obstacle. I know this court has taken issue with the timing of the arraignment, but even if the court takes issue with that, that's not dispositive of this case. There was a government-created issue when Mr. Davis was unable, by no fault of his own, to confer with his counsel after he invoked the right to counsel to file a substitution request in a timely manner under the statute or the local rule. And the state has given no explanation of how Mr. Davis or any defendant in his position would ever be able to intelligently exercise that right without conferring with counsel in this sort of situation. So I'm asking this court to find that the court had a plain duty to grant the request for substitution. I'm asking the court to, if this court deems it appropriate, to provide guidance and somehow find consistency among the courts so this doesn't happen in the future. But we would ask the court to grant the writ here.
All right. Thank you. Thank you for interesting oral argument this morning. The court is adjourned. We'll reconvene for the second oral argument when the courtroom is prepared.
You believe so or you know so?
That individual was named?
No, why you did it. Is that in here somewhere that says the only reason you asked for Giglio was because...
I believe I briefed that to the Court of Appeals because it was brought up, that same thing, and I said I'm being punished.
In the record.
In our record.
I don't know, so I apologize. Okay. And I don't want to go out of bounds here. I'm sorry. Okay. Going back to the reason versus consequences, the chief admitted it was a part of his decision, so it can't be a consequence of the decision. It cannot be a consequence of the decision if it's a reason for the decision. The reason I fired him was because of the testimony piece. That's what he said. He didn't say a consequence of me firing him is that he can no longer testify. or a consequence of the Facebook post is that he can no longer testify because the Facebook posts were covered in charge one, which again is not an issue, and the penalty for that was 30 days. We've also had a lot of discussion about, there's been talk about Laudermill being flexible, and I want to go back to that because, again, Milwaukee is unique statewide in 6250 sub 18 in that the deprivation occurs right away, not after a hearing. And that's really important because once that personnel order was issued on September 12, 2018, notice had to be given before that and an opportunity to respond had to be given before that, had to be afforded to Officer Andrade before that, before September 12, 2018. And that didn't occur. Opposing counsel's admitted that. That did not occur. Laudermill's not flexible on that point. It says those two things are essential. I see I'm out of time.
You
Thank
may
you
finish
very much.
Your sentence if you'd like to.
I'm good. Thank
okay.
you very much.
All right.
Appreciate
Thank
it.
You very much. Interesting oral argument. We are adjourned. We'll reconvene open conference at 1:30, but the people from the classes and anyone else who would like to stay could do so and meet with Justice Karofsky.